Episode 16 of Undisclosed Second Season is brought to you by three great sponsors. They include ABC's legal drama Conviction, longtime friend of the show Stamps.com, and our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hi, and welcome to episode 16 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and a fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In an earlier undisclosed episode, we discussed how Stanley Sutton had enticed jailhouse informants to come forward with information connecting his suspects to Isaac's murder. And we also hinted that, in his desperation to move the investigation forward, he had to entice other agencies, including federal law enforcement, to also get involved. But that's not an easy thing to do. After all, government agencies have limited resources and limited jurisdiction. They only step into local cases in certain situations. So wait till you hear what Sutton had to do to get their attention.
In the fifth season of the TV show The Wire, Detective Jimmy McNulty is trying to get a wiretap approved for Marlo Stanfield, the next generation drug dealer who has risen from the ashes of Avon Barksdale's drug monopoly. The first season of this show had featured McNulty doing mostly good, solid detective work to get wiretaps that would eventually crack the case against Barksdale and his partner in crime, Stringer Bell. But now, faced with a more dangerous and elusive target, McNulty begins taking extreme measures. First, in an attempt to get publicity for a string of murders that might be connected to Stanfield, McNulty plants a ribbon on a victim's wrist to raise the specter of a serial killer with a signature crime. Then, when a Baltimore Sun reporter based upon real-life reporters like Stephen Glass and Jason Blair makes up the claim that he received a payphone call from the supposed serial killer, McNulty substitutes Stanfield's cell phone number as the source of the fabricated call so that he can get a wiretap that will take down Stanfield. Now, some criticize the fifth season of The Wire for straying into surrealism, but I think it's intriguing in showing the personal and professional destruction of a man the audience once sided with. The question, as is often the case, is whether the ends justify the means, with the means in this case being a detective who has reached a dead end, making things up to get a lifeline. As in much of pop culture, the ends are clear. Stanfield is an obvious threat and he must be taken down. But what if the wiretap ended up striking out? And what if it became clear that Stanfield was an innocent man having his privacy invaded and his friends enticed to implicate him? These are the questions raised by the investigation and prosecution of Joey Watkins.
One week after the Floyd County Police Department was assigned to the case, yet another investigative agency was brought onto the case as well. That would be the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. The nature of the GBI's involvement wasn't clear until recently, when Claire obtained copies of the Floyd County Police Department's case file. Prior to that, aside from the involvement of the GBI crime lab, the fact that a GBI agent had done any investigation in the case actually wasn't known. It only got a few glancing mentions, like when Sutton testified at the preliminary hearing that a GBI agent had been assigned, but that's all. So Claire sent in an open records request for the GBI's file on the investigation, and then later, she had a follow-up meeting with them to get their help in interpreting what she'd received, what the GBI agent had actually done.
Hi, this is Claire Gilbert with the Georgia Innocence Project. I'm here talking with my boss, Amy Maxwell, and my colleague, Christina Cribbs. And I am just debriefing them about a meeting I just had with the GBI. I met with the agent, Lisa Harris, there, who is in charge of the Open Records Act request.
A big thing Claire wanted to learn more about was why exactly the GBI's file had been so skimpy.
So the first thing that we talked about was there was a GBI agent that had been brought on board the case in March of 2000 after Stanley Sutton got on board. So it looks like Stanley Sutton recruited Agent Garman, and he had a case file that was released to us by GBI, which is very sparse. There are about five different entries in his case file, mainly just communications that he had had with Detective Mosier and Sergeant Stanley Sutton of the Floyd County Police Department, and summaries of meetings that he had had with them. But there's no description anywhere in here, or no indication anywhere in Agent Garman's case file of any actions actually taken by Agent Garman. Nothing that he'd investigated, no witnesses that he had contacted, no crime scenes that he had visited, nothing like that. And I'm not from Georgia, and I did not know what the GBI was, I knew what they were, but I didn't realize what kind of role a GBI agent would take if they were invited in to cooperate on a case. And I learned from Lisa that this case file of Agent Garman's is very atypical. It was very unusual to her. So even though my request was tailored just for Agent Garman's notes, because I was looking for something different, she released the whole file to me because there really wasn't much in it at all. And she sent a letter with it saying that it was the complete case file. But she said this was very unusual, just to have an agent come in and then not really take any steps on the case whatsoever. It may have been a situation where Stanley Sutton, or whoever invited Agent Garman, was friends with Agent Garman and just wanted to loop him in. It could have been a situation where Agent Garman came on board and then got overwhelmed with other stuff that he was doing and not worked on the case. But she said that this type of case file, which consists of only less than 30 pages of documents, is very unusual. So that's the first thing. Then we talked about the fact that Agent Garman went to prison. He was ultimately terminated from the GBI, or perhaps voluntarily resigned, and prosecuted for some illegal gun stuff. So we talked about how to access his internal affairs file with the GBI, so they released that.
Did they explain to you how GBI becomes involved in an investigation and what their role is statewide?
We did talk about that quite a bit, but she did indicate that it was pretty rare for them just to sort of sit back and watch what was going on without playing any kind of active role.
And so they're a state agency, but they don't have jurisdiction all over the state. They have to be invited in by the local municipality or state or county police or as sheriffs. So they have to be invited in. Mm. So that's why it was important that Sutton invited them in, right?
Yeah.
How do we know that Sutton got Garman involved in the case?
Well, what we do know is that Agent Garman was first invited to participate in the case on March 7th. And there doesn't seem to be any contact with him before then. We know that Stanley Sutton came on board on February 28th, and after he came on board, we know that he was attempting to convene a meeting with multiple agencies, of which the three that I can figure out so far are the GBI, and it was Agent Garman, as well as Rome Police Department and Floyd County.
Even though the GBI file was thin, it left us with a number of questions. It referenced documents we'd never heard of and weren't included with Agent Garman's reports, as well as witness interviews that were never brought up at trial. Because the GBI's file wasn't giving up much in the way of answers, Claire then tracked down James Garman himself, and he agreed to meet her and Susan at the Cartersville Public Library to talk to them about what he could remember. He didn't remember all that much. But to our surprise, he said it had been Detective Moser with the Rome Police Department that had requested his involvement, not Sutton from Floyd County Police Department. And there's one thing he did remember. The case had been fraught with tension from the start. From the Rome Police Department, from the Floyd County Police Department, from the family. He couldn't remember details about the case or where various documents referenced from his reports could be located, but the tension, that he did remember.
Well, it's about a week after okay. Sutton is on board that they have that first meeting. I still think it's probably a Sutton connection.
He said it seemed to be, it didn't seem like an actual conversation so much as, for whatever reason, the GBI agent said that he had the impression that Moser was not thrilled about bringing them on. He put it that you wouldn't, I mean, it happens, but you wouldn't, like, have your boss tell you to bring someone else in your case, do your job for you. And that was how he described the situation with Rome contacting him.
Well, yeah, and I think also that the family was getting frustrated that nothing was being solved.
And Rome was frustrated with the family. He also did not recall anything about an accomplice in this case.
Which is interesting in that, I mean, that suggests to me that the conversations, the memorable conversations and the impressions that he had from his conversations with Stanley Sutton were all about Joey.
He said Sutton was confident he had the right guy. That conversation he remembered.
Yep. And that they, he doesn't recall ever talking about other possible suspects. And that if documents referenced as going to be provided, but then there's not a note, an attachment, note referencing an attachment or another addendum saying that they were provided, then they probably were never provided.
And but that they should exist in the Floyd or the Rome case file.
And things may have just fallen through the cracks in the GBI file.
Well, I was wondering, I kind of took it as him saying things could have fallen through the cracks on the Floyd side, and they never provided the documents. But maybe not.
Listening back to this audio from after our interview with Garmin, I can hear how much more somber than usual our tone is. Well, relatively anyway. But that interview with Agent Garmin was probably something at the low point of this whole investigation. Claire was so frustrated after that interview, although frustrated probably isn't the word for it. It's the only time, though, so far I've seen her demoralized during the course of this case. Maybe the word I'm looking for is disgusted, because Agent Garmin never could explain to us why exactly the GBI's file had been so thin, or offer any explanation for why the documents referenced in his reports weren't present in either the GBI's file, or their own police departments, or the Floyd County Police Departments. And he never could explain even what he was doing on the case, why he was even involved at all. Maybe the explanation is simple. It's the one that was suggested to Claire by a few people after they'd looked at the file. That Sutton had been doing Garmin a favor by throwing him a case that he could use to boost his stats without actually doing much in the way of work. Or maybe there was something more to it. After all, Sutton was lying to witnesses about the extent of the GBI's involvement. In the Kelly Robinson tape, the one her dad recorded at their house when Sutton and Chiflet came by for an interview, you can hear Sutton say at one point that the GBI had only come out one time, and that was it. That's all they knew about the case, and they had no ability to say anything more on what might have transpired. But Sutton's notes show that there were multiple calls and meetings with the GBI over the course of the investigation. Most with Garmin and a few other agents, but we still have no idea why Sutton might have been lying about that or why he was trying to hide how many times he met with the GBI, when in reality it wasn't all that much over the course of a year. Who knows? The Floyd County Police Department and the Rome Police Department won't explain why the GBI was brought in, and the GBI seemingly can't explain what on earth its agent was doing on this case in the first place. So I guess we're left with that.
Conviction is a new crime drama airing Mondays at 10, 9 central on ABC. What makes this show different is that while most crime stories end behind bars, that's where Conviction begins. Each year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongfully convicted. They could be victims of forensic errors, evidence tampering, and more. Inspired by real-life conviction integrity units across the country, the CIU's purpose is to review potentially wrongful verdicts, investigate, then recommend that the sentence be overturned or let stand. And they have just 5 days per case. The CIU team, made up of lawyers, a former detective, and forensic experts, is led by Hayes Morrison, an ex-president's daughter and reformed party girl who now stands as a defender for the unjustly prosecuted. She is not afraid to raise a little hell and is known not only for her feisty attitude but also her willingness to question every part of the judicial system. In this week's Torn from the Headlines episode, when a wealthy suburban family invited a troubled youth into their home, their generosity was repaid with murder. But when the case comes into question, a whole new battle of the haves versus the have-nots is reignited, and the picture-perfect surface of this family portrait is shattered by a multitude of homicidal twists. It's a case that will have you guessing and second-guessing right up into the very last minute of the episode. From the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction airs Mondays at 10, 9 central after Dancing with the Stars on ABC. Yeah, and the GBI wasn't the only outside agency that was brought into this investigation. The Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, also played a role, something that was mentioned obliquely in Sutton's notes but never fully explained.
We weren't really sure the FBI had actually done anything here, that they actually were involved. Maybe it was like a typo in the transcript when Sutton says FBI, and really he meant GBI. But Claire thought that, yeah, if Sutton said FBI in the transcripts, he probably said FBI in real life, and it's worth looking for the file.
Back in August, the FBI finally responded to a FOIA request that Claire had sent in asking for more information about their possible involvement in Joey's case.
Joey.
Yes, ma'am.
You don't have to call me ma'am. I got a very interesting thing in the mail today from the Federal Bureau of Investigations. We did a FOIA request and we got the response back finally today. And it says, synopsis, open and assign, every time I say blank, it means that the feds have blanked out a part of the form I'm reading, so I don't know what it says. So it's assigned to Special Agent Blank to assist Floyd County Police Department in murder investigation believed to have been committed by gang led by Joseph Samuel Watkins.
A gang?
Investigation has revealed that a gang controlled by Subject Watkins has systematically terrorized various persons in the Rome, Floyd County, and Cedarton, Georgia area using firearms, threats of violence, actual violence, to intimidate individuals Watkins opposes. Investigation has also revealed that during the night of the murder described above and the next day, Watkins traveled into Alabama to establish an alibi and possibly destroy evidence using interstate communication facilities during the commission and aftermath of the crime.
What?
And
that is crazy.
This included a request to assist in the investigation of the gang-related homicide of Isaac Dawkins. And then they further say the Floyd County Police Department requested assistance to address gang-related issues of their investigation had developed, revolving around subject Joseph Samuel Watkins. There was also a possibility of the use of FBI polygraph operators. However, shortly after this case was opened, a lead developed blank, 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 regarding the murder of Isaac Dawkins. As a result, arrests were made for murder without any further investigation by the FBI. Indictments have been returned and a trial date has been set for the defendants in this matter. As a result of the arrest of Watkins, blank. The gang-related activity ended because of the lack of Watkins' involvement. Therefore, this case should be closed due to the arrests and charges of Watkins and others.
What?
I know. It's crazy. And this was right around, this is at the beginning of November, November 1 and November 8.
These people really said that I was in a gang.
Not any gang. Well, the baddest gang Rome has ever seen, apparently. And you're the leader.
What? Wow.
And note that it is a nameless gang. I can't say that I've ever seen a gang-related document that doesn't reference the name of the gang.
Are you serious?
Apparently you had a nameless gang.
Now, the part where it says a lead developed blank, 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 blank is we're pretty sure a redacted reference to Josh Flemister's confession that we mentioned previously in Virginia, or at least the reason listed for the redaction is due to an informant. But everything else is really just sort of crazy. There's no basis for it either in reality or the Floyd County Police Department's case files. In fact, their own investigation didn't support any of the claims the FBI report was making.
Yeah.
Man, are you serious? These people. They said I was in a gang. I was a gang leader.
It's really fascinating because, you know, we have poured through, like 9 or 10,000 pages of documents at this point. Is it that many? It's probably 8,000 pages of documents at this point. And not once anywhere in any of those documents is there the slightest hint that you might be associated with a gang. Not even one time. And here they are recruiting the FBI because you're a violent.
Man, these people are such liars, man. I cannot believe this. See, this is the first I've heard of this.
Ever heard of it. First anyone has.
Are you? Well, look, I'll tell you guys this. I've been locked up, 16 years now? And you can pull up my GDC file and in the 16 years that I've been locked up, there is nothing that can connect me with any kind of gang. Don't you think if I was some kind of gang leader or big bad guy like that, this would have followed me?
I don't think that Floyd County remotely thinks you're a gang member. It never even entered their head except to lie to the FBI to get them involved. There has to be some reason for federal involvement.
From the FBI's file, it's clear Sutton used two reasons to get federal involvement in the case. The first was that Joey was the kingpin of a gang that, quote, systematically terrorized people in the Floyd and Polk County areas that Joey opposed. And this is sort of what I would call the McNulty moment, because just as we had McNulty raising the specter of this serial killer in Baltimore, that's exactly what Sutton is doing here. He is claiming that Joey is this mastermind who's the head of this gang that's terrorizing Floyd and Polk counties, and that's the way initially he's trying to get the FBI involved. And there's the second way. The second way in which he tries to get the FBI involved is through claiming interstate activity. That, as the FBI report says, during the night of the murder and the next day, Watkins traveled to Alabama to establish an alibi and possibly destroy evidence using interstate communications facilities during the commission and aftermath of the crime.
Which is kind of hilarious, and by hilarious I mean kind of sickening, because Sutton had been telling all kinds of witnesses, like Aslan Hoag, that Joey had been lying to everyone about going to Alabama that day, both the day of the murder and the following day, because his phone records, Sutton said, showed he'd never been in Alabama in the first place. But when Sutton was talking to the FBI and trying to establish federal jurisdiction, he told them the exact opposite, that Joey had been in Alabama and that they knew it because he was using interstate communication facilities, aka his cell phone.
Now, the FBI was called in at the end of October, and Aslan's statements, where she described how Sutton showed her the phone records proving that Joey had lied, was from before that, on October 4th. So, theoretically, it's possible that Sutton had truly believed that Joey was lying about Alabama when he talked to Aslan, and then he learned the truth somehow at the end of the month. But if so, Sutton interviewed Aslan again in January of 2001, and he made no attempt to inform her that he had been wrong before, and that Joey had not been lying to her. So why was the FBI brought into the case anyway? Well, that part's not clear. At Joey and Mark's preliminary hearing, Sutton testified that some guy from the FBI had been brought on to help, but he didn't really do anything. He said, "I can't recall his name. I never met the guy. He just assisted me in trying to locate a projectile at the residence where the dog had got shot."
Sutton's notes show that on November 9th, the same day that Paul called and told them about Josh Flemister, Sutton had called FBI, profile, and FBI polygraph, whatever that means. And records from a wiretap on Joey's home the previous month in October had at least one FBI agent, Agent Meadows, that had been monitoring the wire. Anyway, whatever the FBI was brought in to do, it came in on the basis of the Floyd County Police Department's apparent allegations that suspect Joey Watkins was, again, some huge gang leader with Mark Free as his lieutenant, sort of the relationship of Avon Barksdale and Stringer Bell. But a gang takes more than two people, so in addition to Joey Watkins and Mark Free, who else was in the supposed gang? The FBI's report only names one other individual, and it's redacted. We can see how many characters in the name, though, and based on what else was going on in the investigation at the time, it's clear this other, quote, gang member is the third suspect in Isaac's murder, Mark's friend, David Brown. Now, at this point, you're probably saying, who's David Brown again? Which one is he? But it's not anyone you should recognize at this point because he's not someone we've discussed in the show so far. The only real appearance he makes in this case is in Sutton's imagination. Nevertheless, David Brown was officially listed as a suspect in Floyd County's case file and also apparently in Floyd County's communications with the FBI. But why?
The evidence against Mark mostly consisted of jailhouse informants. But one component of the state's case against Mark, as it was against Joey, was evidence that Mark had fabricated an alibi. Mark, the state argued, had gotten his friend David Brown to lie for him, to say that Mark had been with him the night of the murder. It's not surprising, though, that Mark's alibi would have been David, because around that time, that's who he spent most of his time with, and who he was basically living with. But at trial, David testified that no, he hadn't been with Mark the night Isaac was shot. Yeah, he'd seen Mark that day, but it was at some point earlier, not sure exactly when, and then Mark had left with his girlfriend. And David said he hadn't seen him again after that. At first, though, in the initial months after Isaac's murder, things had gone differently in the investigation. David had been able to back up Mark's alibi. Way back in March, when the RPD was still on the case and still actively involved, Jim Moser and Marshall Smith had interviewed Mark for the first time because of what jailhouse informant Joey Samples had told them. Mark said in that interview that he'd been with David when Isaac was shot, and based on Moser's notes, the police seemed to have believed Mark. And, at least initially, David also backed up Mark's alibi. Because the next day, on March 8th, Moser went to interview David, and David told him, yeah, I remember that night. Mark was with me. We watched a movie, got Church's chicken, and then Mark got a phone call from a friend of ours, Johnny Williams. Johnny mentioned that this guy Isaac had been shot, and Mark's reaction was to be surprised, saying, no way. What happened? Anyway, according to Moser's notes, David told him that, to the best of his knowledge, Mark had been with him on January 11th, 2000, at 7:15 p.m.
And that was it for David's involvement, at least for a while. Mark had an alibi, other witnesses could confirm it, end of story. But then, 7 months later, long after Sutton had taken over the case, and around when they were starting to get truly desperate because their investigation wasn't going anywhere, the police came calling once again. On October 2nd, Tommy Shiflett and Stanley Sutton interviewed David again. And this time, David tells them the same thing. Mark was with him that night. He was positive. He remembered that Mark and Mark's ex-girlfriend had come over to his place where they'd watched some movie about rattlesnakes. Then at some point, their friend Johnny Williams called and told Mark about Isaac being shot. He was sure that was the same day as Isaac's death, David told them, because he remembered right after that, Mark had left his house and been arrested for a parole violation. He remembered that part well. Now, David's statement was actually a big problem for Mark and Joey, and pretty good news for the Floyd County officers, because it meant that, suddenly, Mark's great alibi wasn't so great at all. Because a jail record showed that Mark hadn't been arrested on January 11th. He'd been arrested the following day, on the 12th. So Sutton and Shiflett go and pull Mark out of jail where he was being held, again, on another probation violation. They brought him up to the Floyd County Police Department and interviewed him intensely, saying they knew he was guilty and that Joey had been confessing. Mark told them there's no way Joey was saying he was with him because he'd been with David Brown that day.
There's no recording of the interview, at least not officially. But I have my doubts about that. Shiflett's summary seems too detailed in parts, as if he actually had a recorded version to go off of, not just scrambled handwritten notes. And also, there's no handwritten notes from the interview at all. In every other case where an officer had interviewed someone and had not recorded it, there seems to have been, like, a record of somewhere, a few lines jotted down on lined paper. And there's none for this one. And moreover, Mark himself has clear memories of a recorder being present and turned on. He's pretty confident about that. Whether it's recorded or not, though, there's one section included in the Floyd County summary of the interview that seems to outright say that Sutton told Mark that he needed to tell them that Joey had confessed. Here's what the summary says.
Sutton asked Free if he wasn't there and he didn't kill Isaac with Joey, then Joey told him that he did it. Free said, I swear to God and my mama's life and my daddy's life that I didn't do it, and Joey didn't tell me that he did it. Sutton told him that he was lying, and he could tell by the way Free was acting that he was lying.
I showed Mark this summary from his interview with the cops, and he said that it actually looked pretty accurate. Other than that, they left some stuff out anyway. Like how Sutton and Shiflett had both interviewed him separately, and then come in and interviewed him together. According to Mark, anyway, in that interview, it had been Sutton that played good cop, and it was Shiflett playing the bad cop. And they also left out how Mark said he'd cussed them out, told them they were full of shit, and they should either arrest him right then and there, or else shut up and take him back to jail. That part, for some reason, didn't make it into Floyd County's interview report.
But Mark had confirmed more or less that he thought he'd been with David on the night of the murder. And they now knew that had not been the night of the murder at all. It was actually the night after. So the cops would interpret this as an attempt to falsify an alibi, because obviously Mark had known the real date of the murder since he'd done it, so he must have known the date he was talking about wasn't the right one. But why would Mark attempt to use David as a false alibi if he knew he hadn't been with David until the day after the murder? Why didn't he just get David to say that Mark had been with him on the right date?
The other explanation, the one that seems to me to be much more obvious anyway, is this. Both Mark and David had wrongly believed that the day Johnny called and said, hey, did you hear this kid Isaac got shot and killed? Was in fact the day that Isaac had been shot and killed. But it wasn't. Isaac had died on the 12th, but the actual crime, the actual shooting on Highway 27, that had taken place the day before, on the 11th. Something neither David nor Mark would have had reason to know if they'd first learned of the shooting from Johnny's call on the 12th. After all, Isaac had been shot around 7 p.m., and a little after 7 p.m., like around 8:30 that evening, they'd gotten the call from Johnny, telling them that Isaac was shot. 2 months later, when they were questioned for the first time by the police, and asked for the first time about where they'd been the day Isaac was shot and killed, they both thought the same thing, that it had been the day that they'd gotten that call.
Yeah, so it wasn't until October that anyone realized this mistake, and of course, 10 months later, no one Mark had been hanging with back in January could remember which day exactly had been January 11th. The 12th, that day they remembered, or at least the part of it where Mark had gotten the call from Johnny, but the day before that, well, it was hard to be sure.
I was hanging out with David a lot then. Me and Joey hadn't hung out in a minute. It was probably two or three months since we really hung out. And I was hanging out with David and talking to Johnny. So I really couldn't be really clear on where I was on the 11th. I mean, I can't recall. It was so long in between that time, I can't remember.
Yeah.
And by the time you were a suspect,
yes.
You know, it's far enough away from the actual date that you may well not remember what you're doing.
I knew I was hanging out with David a lot, and it was like a blur, I guess. I know I wouldn't commit murder that night. I know I wouldn't marry.
Now, Mark eventually did piece together what he thinks is a timeline for his day on January 11th, and at Joey's trial, when he was given immunity and put in the stand by the prosecution, he testified to what he thought he could recall. That he'd hung out with David, and then sometime early in the evening, he'd talked to his sister, who told him his niece had skipped school that day, and she asked him to come talk to her. So his girlfriend had driven him to see his sister just north of Rome at Swan Lake, or at least he's pretty sure of that. Mark didn't have a license, so he'd have to have someone drive him everywhere. He couldn't have gone anywhere alone anyway. So he thinks he got to his sister's around 7 p.m. because later than that, and she'd already have left for work before he got there. So then he stayed there for a couple of hours, and then around 9 p.m., his girlfriend drove him back to David's, where he spent the night, since that's where he was staying at the time.
But at trial, David contradicted that. He said yes, he'd hung out with Mark at some point that day, and he thinks Mark was with his girlfriend, but after that, well, he hadn't seen Mark again that evening. And maybe he hadn't. It's clear that no one is completely sure about the details of that day. Mark's girlfriend testified that she remembered the night they'd gone to see Mark's niece, but she had no idea what the date had been. Besides, Mark's alibi for after 9 p.m. didn't much matter when the murder was just after 7 p.m. Still, David's testimony was used by the prosecution to prove that Mark had lied about his whereabouts on the day that Isaac was killed.
Sometimes it feels like there aren't enough hours in the day, even when you're working past the 9 to 5. So if you're still making time-consuming trips to the post office, you need a better way. Use Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you get the postage you need the instant you need it. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. You'll save money with Stamps.com, too. It's just a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. Now, unfortunately, a few days ago, I had to make my first trip to the post office in about 6 months, and it was a nightmare. The closest post office was closed during my lunch hour, the next closest didn't have any extended hours, so I had to take valuable time out of my day just to go to the post office. Stamps.com makes it so much easier. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code UNDISCLOSED for a special offer. It's a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com, enter UNDISCLOSED.
It took me a while before I was able to talk to David. Mark and him are no longer close and have actually only seen each other once since the trial. But finally, Mark reached out to David for me. He told me that he'd asked David to make things right between them by speaking up for him, by speaking to me. He told him not to be afraid of Sutton and Shiflett, that, hey, they'd try to put him away for life, but he was still around. Besides, Mark said, it's not as if the FCPD could do anything to David now. And David finally agreed to talk to me. He gave me a call back over the summer, and when we talked, he was open and willing to answer any questions I had. I could kind of get a sense of why he'd been reluctant to call me, though. It seemed like he still felt some lingering embarrassment about what he'd agreed to do back then, and the things he'd said to Sutton and done for him. He'd never lied about anything, though, or given false statements about what Mark or Joey had done. He didn't perjure himself, he didn't do anything like that. But it's hard to deny that, on the stand, he'd told the truth in a way that was designed to fit the state's case. And there's a fact that, during the investigation, he'd unknowingly worn a wire and recorded Joey and Mark at the request of Sutton and Shiflett. David seemed to recognize all that, and he wasn't so much defensive about it as he was kind of just resigned to what had happened back then.
I didn't even want to go to court. The whole deal about the alibi, I didn't even want to go. And they're like, well, you're going to have to go. And all I said when we got to court was you with Mark in this time? And I said, no, I don't think I was. I said, but I really can't remember, you know. I said, go, who can remember something that far? But I mean.
But that's not quite what David had testified to. At Joey's trial, he did say he thought Mark's girlfriend was his alibi, but he definitively stated Mark had not been with him that night. So here is the transcript of his testimony.
Question, he didn't go stay at your house all day and then go over to his sister's house and come back? Answer, well, I seen him that day and he left with Mika. Question, you saw him that day but he wasn't over at your house? Answer, Question, and he didn't spend the night with you? Answer, no.
But again, for all anyone knows, this could be true. In October when the date mix-up was discovered, no one could remember the 11th with 100% certainty. And besides, Mark's testimony was that he'd left his sister's and headed back to David's at 9 p.m. long after the crime and long after he even needed an alibi.
And this is another area where I wish defense counsel had at least, I mean, they did point it out through their questioning, but never really seemed to bring the point home. Yes, there's this discrepancy between what Mark said his alibi was and David's ability to verify it, but they only really differ when it comes to the after 9 p.m. part of the night. So maybe Mark misremembered that he went and stayed with David. Maybe he went and stayed with his girlfriend instead. But none of that has any bearing on the murder. And somehow the state was able to present it as evidence of lying instead of evidence of well, nothing like it really is.
So yeah, maybe David's testimony was a shade more definitive than warranted, but it wasn't a lie, and he'd never meant to hurt Mark, who was his best friend, and he'd had nothing against Joey either. He just needed the cops to leave him alone.
I mean, every day I'd come home from work, and there he'd be at my job, take me up there to the police station, or come by my house or something.
How many times did this happen, do you think, roughly?
I know he come by my job. I know they come by my job at least twice.
Mm-hmm. And then by your house as well?
Yeah, they come by my house a few times, too.
And it wasn't just that Sutton was constantly there dragging him down to the police station. In fact, Sutton had leverage against David.
Well, they just kept threatening me, you know. You're on probation. All I got to do is catch you lying, and I'll put you in jail, you know, and you'll get a probation violation. That's what Sutton kept telling me. And I guess if I hadn't been on probation, I just told them to shove off. I wouldn't have had nothing to do with it or nothing like that. But that's basically all I know. That's how I come about in all of it.
So what did they say to you down at the station?
I can't really remember. It's been so long. All I can remember is being really scared. And it wasn't so much Tommy Shiflett as it was Stanley Sutton, because he was, I know you know about this and all this. And I said, I do not know about this. And he just, I know you know. I know, he told y'all are best friends. He said, y'all done been but he's been arrested at your house before. And I know you know more what you're saying. And I said, I do not know nothing about this. I mean, Stanley was just, he was hard up on me, kept saying, I know you know all this and everything. And that's the only reason that I did what I did in the trial was because I was scared.
And when you say you did what you did, what are you referring to?
Like the recording and all that crap. Because they told me, they said, well, how do we know you're telling us the truth or whatever? I said, I don't care. I want to be left alone. And Stanley Sutton would never leave me alone. And they was like, well, when you talk to Mark or whatever, we need to know that you talked to us. And they even asked me, they said, do you think Mark would kill somebody? And I told them, no. I said, Mark's not the type of person that would kill somebody. He's more the type of person that would hit them in the mouth or beat the crap out of them or something like that. I could never see Mark. I'm telling you, I grew up with him, and I could never see Mark free killing nobody.
And to be fair, David had better reason than most to not wanting to risk going to jail on Mark's behalf, because he'd already done that, and that's why he was on probation in the first place. It happened one night when David was being harassed by a couple of guys who kept driving by his place. Finally, him and Mark drove after them.
And we get down to the end of the road, the red light catches them. So me and Mark get out of the car and go up there, and I'm like, what are y'all doing? Why do y'all keep messing with me? About that time, Mark hauls off and hits the boy, you know? And Mark was on probation at the time, and when we get to the jail, I told him that I did it, that I was the one that hit him. That Mark didn't hit him, and I'll take the blame for it. And Mark went home, and I stayed in jail, and my brother-in-law came and got me out later on that evening. But that's why I was on probation to begin with, and I was like, you know what? I'm already on probation. You know, I'm not going to get no more trouble, for him. I'm just going to go ahead, and I'm going to... Because they kept telling me, if you lie to me and I find out, I'll make sure you go to jail and your probation's revoked. Sutton kept telling me that.
But David never actually knew back then of his real status in the case, that the Floyd County Police Department and the FBI's paperwork had named him during the fall of 2000 as the third conspirator in Isaac's murder. In all the times that they threatened him with revoking his probation if he didn't talk, they didn't actually mention that they were considering him as a candidate for a murder charge.
My mistake. I assumed you'd known that you were officially a suspect in the case.
No. Yeah. I never knew that.
They obviously, after the wiretap, or the recorded calls you did, I guess they lost interest in you. But that's why they had a wiretap on you.
No, I never knew that.
Yeah.
Because you can even ask Mark. As far as me, him, and Joey ever going anywhere together, I've never went anywhere with Joey Watkins. Me and Mark were best friends from when we were little. And I've never went out party. I mean, and me and Mark used to party together, but I've never partied with Joey Watkins, never.
But just from the pressure of the repeated questioning from Sutton and Shiflett, David finally gave in. At Sutton and the Shiflett's request, he agreed to initiate and record a phone call with Mark, and that he'd then hand the recording over to the cops.
Hi. What you doing, shithead?
Not much. What you doing?
Nothing. Been getting goddamn harassed.
By?
The police.
Have you?
Yep.
I figured you had. They fucking come and got me again out of jail Monday.
But, yeah, Stanley Sutton got all up my face and shit, asked me questions. And I told him the truth. I mean, I really don't know nothing about nothing.
Yeah.
And, I told him about how that next day you went to jail and everything after you got the phone call that one day.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Well, they fucking said they'll charge me and Joe with murder and all kind of shit. I said, well, fucking do it then. They couldn't because they ain't got it. We talked to my lawyer today, so.
Man, they've been goddamn. I've been worried to death, you know.
Yeah. They try and put it on us, but they can't.
Do you think he did it, man?
Nah.
Well, how the fuck did they come up with all this shit, Mark?
Brianne. I think it's jealousy and shit. You just have to know about. It's just a bunch
so,
of
like things. I told him, I said, hell, I don't know that Isaac boy, and I don't know his sister, and I said, I've known Joy for a long time, but I ain't never been around him about 10 times at the most. And I hadn't.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, that is some gang Joey led if he'd only seen his second most important gang member 10 times in his whole life. But despite David's protest now in 2016, part of me can't help but wonder if maybe he hadn't always been so confident in Mark's innocence. Maybe the Floyd County officers had gotten into his head. Because at times during the recording, it sounds like David may have had his doubts.
Just swear to me, man. You didn't have nothing to do with it. Me and you been like brothers.
Man, don't fucking ask me no shit like that.
Well, I mean, we've been...
You know me better than that.
Well, I know, but we've been like brothers for years, man. You know what? If somebody was telling me you did some bullshit like that, I wouldn't believe it.
It's just some bullshit.
Or maybe David was just putting on a show for the Floyd County officers, trying to get Mark to say something to convince them of his innocence. I don't know. But I can see how hard it'd be to not doubt, after hearing Sutton's monologue of guilt, after hearing his list of all the evidence he supposedly had showing how terrible Joey and Mark were and the things they'd done together. How could hearing that, on multiple occasions, not start to affect your relationship with the person being accused?
We're going to take a quick break now to check in with Blue Apron, one of our tastiest sponsors. Now, Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Every single week, they will deliver right to your front door impeccably packaged fresh produce and every single ingredient, including spices that you need to make delicious, healthy, wholesome, and beautiful looking home cooked meals for your family. Even if you've never touched a pot or pan in your life, Blue Apron's step-by-step color guides will help you look like a gourmet chef. And you can even pull in other folks to cook with you because cooking together, studies show, builds strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families actually cook together nearly 3 times more often. That's pretty amazing. And you're going to save money because Blue Apron meals cost less than $10 per person per meal. And if you consider the kinds of quality, ethically sourced ingredients that they send you, incredible produce and meat and dairy, you're not going to be able to find this stuff in this kind of budget anywhere. Whether you eat out or you get the groceries by yourself, you're just not going to be able to do it. And most importantly, you're never going to get bored because their variety is amazing. They never repeat a recipe in a year. The recipes change every single week. And I want you to hear some of the meals that they offer in November. Pan-seared chicken with roasted fall vegetables and butter caper sauce, spicy lotus root and purple carrot stir-fry with sweet potato noodles, lemongrass roasted pork with Romanesco cauliflower and coconut rice. So whether you need meat in every meal or you're a straight-up vegetarian, the variety is tremendous. So definitely check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. Yep, that's the same coupon code as season 1. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed.
David started the call with Mark by complaining about the police harassment, just like Tommy Shiflett had suggested that he do. And after a bit, Mark brings Joey into the call, so it's a three-way call, so that Joey can also hear about what the cops have been trying to do and say to David.
I got David on three-way.
What are you doing, boy?
What are you doing?
I'm fucking getting harassed.
Huh?
Getting harassed.
What's going on?
Goddamn police, man.
Where at? Sutton fucking went back out there and questioned him again.
Got my goddamn face.
Sutton got in your face.
Got my goddamn face. They took me downtown. And Tommy Rittman told him to leave the office.
This is the same day.
Told him he wasn't going to talk to me like it.
This is the same day that they come and got me. They asked me if I was with David and all this shit again. You remember?
They asked me that five times in a row.
You were with David the night after he got shot? Yeah. Okay.
Well, see, they asked me that, Mark, and I told him, I said, I remember he was there the day we got the call that the boy was dead. And I said, and you'd have to check my work records for the night before.
Yeah.
Now, this recorded call was never transcribed. Only a rough summary was provided to the defense. And it's hard not to wonder if that's because of what Joey and Mark actually say during the call. If because the responses to David are really hard to explain if you're working from a theory of guilt. Like with Joey asking Mark if he was at David's on the night Isaac was shot. Now, sure, Sutton might argue this was all an act put on for David's benefit, but if the alibi was a lie, if Mark hadn't been with David but was telling the police he had been, then David had also been in on the scheme. So why then would Joey and Mark be pretending on a call with David that Mark had been in his place when David had to know it was all a lie? And even aside from the fact that it makes no sense for Joey and Mark to be putting on an intricate act here, nothing about their conversation sounds like two guys who had been carefully plotting their alibis. They aren't even sure of the date of the murder, and all of them still think that Mark had gotten the phone call from Johnny just after the murder had happened and not the following day.
Like I told him, I said, dude, I'm trying to get my life going. I said, I can't keep going to work and coming home and going to the police station staying all night. And I told him the same thing, and I said, you can ask Mark's ex-girlfriend. She was sitting there when we got the phone call, and all that.
I told him the same thing.
And Mark went to jail that next night.
Yeah, I know Mark went to jail.
On the 12th.
I went on the, David. Yeah, it wasn't 12th, it was 13th. No, it wasn't, man. It was after that. It was like the 18th. Because it was after Valentine's Day. I know this was January, that's right. It was like the 12th or 13th.
Isaac got shot on the 12th.
He got shot on the 11th.
I got shot on the 11th, I believe. I don't know when it was.
It was at 11th, man. That's what it says on all them posters.
When I listen to this tape, I try to imagine how the Floyd County officers could have listened to it and maintained their ironclad confidence in Joey's and Mark's guilt. Because they never say anything the least bit incriminating, and they're going in circles trying to piece together what even the date of the murder was. We've got Mark thinking the murder was in February at first before suddenly realizing, oh wait, it was in January. And then Joey starts saying that, oh, it happened on the 12th, with Mark then correcting him. But no, all those reward posters, they all say it was the 11th. And David's there arguing with them both. Is this really supposed to be a carefully fabricated alibi? The conversation with Joey is brief though, and after a few minutes, he gets off the line. With an apology to David that he's gotten sucked into this whole mess with them.
But hey, I just gonna call and let you know that.
I'm fixing to go take me a goddamn shower.
I'm sorry about that, David.
Man, hell. I'm just gonna do what they, you know, answer everything they ask me. And maybe they let me alone one day. I don't know nothing.
Tell them you don't know nothing. But hell, I'll holler at you later, Joey.
All right, bye.
But David and Mark keep talking, and Mark then brings up all the crazy claims Sutton was telling him.
Saying that they had witnesses that said that I like to fight, and I'm pretty good at it, and I like going around. Me and Joe like going around threatening people and bulldogging them and shit. And supposedly we run Buddy Vines down in his car and jerked him out and put a shotgun to his head or some bullshit.
Well, I know that didn't happen. The only time you and Buddy got into it, he had 20 people with him.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. We ain't worried about it. We'll find out tomorrow what's gonna fucking happen.
Well, just promise me something, man.
What's that?
If you do find out Joey's in the middle of all this shit, I know you don't like him. Promise me, get your ass out of trouble, you'll tell him. So they leave you the fuck alone. Don't go down for something stupid, Mark.
I ain't going down for shit, man. I don't know nothing.
But shit, man, I'm gonna go take Miss Shire.
Alrighty, man.
Love you, man.
I'll see ya.
Bye.
From the recording, it's hard to tell what David was really thinking. David says now that he'd always known Mark hadn't done it, and while he didn't really know Joey, he could never believe Joey had done it either, that he was just scared. But as soon as David agreed to record Mark and Joey, the cops got a lot friendlier towards him. They eased off their suspicion of him, the constant harassment and them dragging him down to the police station. But when David is talking to the cops, it's hard not to think he was doubting Joey and Mark's innocence.
Hello.
This is Tommy.
Hey.
Hey.
I just talked to Mark here.
Already?
Yeah, I called him. And guess who the first person was he wanted to call?
Wasn't Joey, was it?
Yep.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did.
That means he wouldn't talk much. He had Joey around. He say anything to you?
Oh, he's just acting weird, man.
He what?
Like, you know, I've always told him I loved him when we'd hang up or whatever. He said, all right, man, and hung up the phone.
I just wanted to know what you'd said, hadn't
you? I got tape over here, about 15 minutes if you want to listen to it. Well, but they talking about how they going to sue y'all, and y'all don't know shit because they ain't done nothing.
Well, anyway, how about if I'm going to ask you, and you can tell me yes or no. If I bring you a clean tape and just take that one you got in there with you and leave another one on there for a day or two.
That'll be fine.
Will you do that?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll be out in a minute.
All right. All right, bye.
Maybe the answer is just that it's both. David was scared and desperate to not wind up in jail for pissing off Stanley Sutton. And also, Stanley Sutton's stories had worked. David thought his best friend was innocent, but all those stories Stanley was telling him, well, it'd be hard for anyone not to have doubts start creeping in.
And David was far from the only person that Mark and Joey knew who were put through this whole routine of Sutton showing up at their workplace, their homes, their friends' homes, their high school graduations, of calling them, calling their parents, finding excuses to show up where they'd be, hounding them basically until they either finally held firm and said no. They didn't know a damn thing and they weren't going to say otherwise. Or, more often, until they relented, at least a tiny bit, and gave up some small offering in the form of a story that implicated Joey or implicated Mark, or just painted them as bad people.
Many of them won't talk to us at all, and others are willing to talk but won't go on the record with their stories about how Sutton questioned them and why they said the things they said back then. But we know the police did the same thing to Josh that they did to David, like when they had the off-the-record heart-to-hearts with him about how he needed to save himself by talking about Joey and how doing so wouldn't implicate Joey because they had other evidence and it wouldn't hurt Mark because Mark himself had confessed.
Is there anything that meant you and I had a heart-to-heart talk about not... You're not allowing yourself to be trapped into this thing anymore. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else other than him asking you to be an alibi? Is there anything else now that you need to put on this record as the final thing we live with?
Just that Joey did have a gun. But the day he came to my house, he did not have it. He didn't show it to me.
They even did it on friends who didn't really know anything at all, like Johnny Williams, the friend of Mark's who called to let him know about Isaac. They got Johnny to deny that he even ever called Mark to tell him about the murder, despite the fact that at least three witnesses all remembered this happening. But Mark's supposed reaction to that call, one of surprise, didn't fit the narrative, so perhaps that's why in late October he'd tell Sutton the call had never occurred when unquestionably it had. And Josh wasn't the only friend of Joey's who was so scared of the pressure from Sutton that he fled Rome to get away from it. Joey's friend Adam Cagle, a different Adam from Adam Elrod, had to move out of town just so his family wouldn't have to deal with the constant Sutton drive-bys.
So I found a note in the files from you, or something you'd said at some point. Why would you have thought that you and Adam Cagle were suspects?
Because Sutton was harassing Adam. That's the whole reason Adam went to Thomasville.
Wait, I don't know about this story.
You don't know about Sutton harassing Adam Cagle?
No.
Okay. Me and Adam were hanging out. This was after Isaac had been shot or whatever, whatnot. Adam and I started hanging out pretty regular again. And me and Adam kept seeing an unmarked police car go by his sister's house, Tara. She lived on Blue Pond Church Road. This was out in Kingston. Well, he kept riding by, So we eventually, Adam said, I think that's Stanley Sutton. And because his dad had been into trouble before, and he knew who Stanley Sutton was. And I was like, okay. I said, all right, I get it now. He's trying to come at you. And about 3 days later, he caught Adam at the rock store right off Kingston Highway and told Adam that Adam was going to tell him how me and Mark Free killed Isaac, or he was going to charge his ass along with us and say that he was with us. So Adam Cagle was like, look, man, I don't know. He told Stanley Sutton, he said, Joey didn't do this, and I don't know shit about this. And Stanley Sutton kept harassing him. Every time he would catch him out or whatever, he kept riding by Tara's house. And Tara told Adam, you're going to have to leave. So Adam left and went to Thomasville with his dad. And Adam didn't come back so long after they convicted me.
So he was going to be Josh before they found Josh?
Right. He tried to do the same thing with Adam that he did with Josh. Tried to get Adam to do that. And Adam pretty much told him to go screw himself.
And got the hell out of town.
And got the hell on.
I'd heard Joey speak fondly of Adam Cagle a few times. He was one of the few friends who stood by Joey through thick and thin, and even after the conviction. And apparently, despite his closeness to Joey, the Floyd County Police didn't succeed in recruiting him as a witness.
And you never knew David Jones, did you?
Never knew David Jones. All I knew, I heard of him, they called him Super Dave. Adam Cagle knew him, but I didn't.
Yeah, they mentioned Adam Cagle on The Wire.
Yeah. Adam Cagle was like my brother. He got killed in 05.
Yeah.
I wish he was still here because he could tell you about all this stuff. Adam was the only one that would come see me every weekend.
He's the only one who didn't talk to Sutton. They look for him.
Right. Because he didn't care. He was a loyal friend. And that's why I pretty much only hung around with him.
Why you talked to him
in
the wire?
Until I was locked up.
But I was wrong there in my conversation with Joey. When I'd spoken to him back in the first half of the year, I'd overlooked a section of Sutton's notes. Later, when I saw something I'd missed before, I thought back on this conversation with Joey and kind of winced, because Adam Cagle, the only friend who'd stood by Joey after his conviction, well, he had given in to pressure from Sutton, too. On October 26, Sutton's notes read,
Thursday, 1800 hours. Adam Cagle, white male. Adam heard that Joey and Damon did shoot Isaac. About the beginning of January, he heard that Joey did it. Joey threatened to kill Kendall Dixon.
Right after that, Adam Cagle had gotten the hell out of Dodge, so he was never used in the case against Joey. And also, I have no idea who Damon is or what that's about, so I'm not sure how Sutton could have even used Adam's statements. But still, Adam Cagle had talked too. It's hard to say, though, that the blame in a case like this falls primarily, or maybe even at all, on those witnesses. I think the results of Sutton's systematic interrogation campaign speaks for itself. No, not every person Joey knew gave into it. Some were interviewed and successfully got away without ever saying anything incriminating against Joey and Mark, or at least nothing that hadn't actually happened. And as a result, never actively assisted in building the cases against them. But if the witnesses named in Sutton's notes gives us a complete set or a mostly complete set of people he talked to, and for the most part, that seems to be the case, then that group who didn't end up talking, they're in the minority. Because most of those witnesses would say something just to get the Floyd County Police off their backs. And some of those witnesses would say just about anything. And although the cost of that falls on Joey more than anyone else, he's not the only one that's felt the consequences of it.
You know, I told him, I said, if Joy didn't do it the other day, this is what I told him. I said, if he didn't do it, you know, he's lost a lot. Mm-hmm. I said, Mark, you lost a lot. You got locked up. I said, but look at me. I lost my best friend over every bit of this crap that I didn't even want to be a part of, that I didn't have nothing to do with. You know, I mean, I wish I had it to go back. I'd have told him, you know what, you put me, you do what you want to do. Put me, but after what you just told me, I'd probably be sitting up there for something I didn't do. Because I mean, they never told me that I was a suspect or nothing like that.
You know, there's no way to say that's not what would happen if you hadn't decided to cooperate. Because Mark, I mean, if Joey got lucky about anything, it's that Mark was never going to bend an inch. The cops tried the same thing on him. They tried very hard to make him flip and promised him he'd get no jail time, no problems, if he could talk. And Mark was like, go to hell.
Yeah.
But
I'm going to tell you this. Are you still recording me?
Yeah, I can turn it off if you want me to.
Mark, no, okay. Keep recording. Mark Free was my best friend. If he would have been with Joy and they'd have killed that boy, Mark would have told me. He never mentioned nothing about it, nothing. And I'm telling you, we were like brothers. If anybody would have known if he'd have had something to do with that, it'd have been me. And he never let up an inch. And that the whole thing with me, I knew he didn't have nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the main reason why I helped him, because I knew he didn't have nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't think the cops could ever get him actually in trouble?
No, I knew they wouldn't ever get him in trouble because I knew he didn't do it.
There seems to be a lot of regret from many of the witnesses, often friends, of Mark and Joey, that the police were able to pressure them into making statements that either implicated the two guys or at least didn't help them. A definite pattern emerges over and over again with many of them, changing statements over time, being threatened, or being enticed with reward money. We see it again and again, and not just in this case. It's actually a common feature of wrongful convictions in general. Another common feature when the state has its back against the wall are jailhouse snitches. Not long ago, attorney Kathleen Zellner, who represents Stephen Avery of Making a Murderer fame, tweeted that she fully expected the state to suddenly discover jailhouse snitches against her client in response to her recent filing to retest the forensic evidence in that case. And in fact, as soon as Adnan's case was overturned and his conviction was thrown out, an attorney with the Innocence Project told me to tell Adnan to be careful, because it was in times like these that the police and prosecutors start making the rounds of prisons to find people they can tempt into becoming snitches. But in order to do that, in order to become a snitch, that person has to know a little bit about the case itself. So this attorney told me to tell Adnan not to keep any case documents in his cell. Scary stuff, right? Well, in Joey's case, we mentioned a few prison snitches in an earlier episode who had come forward when the reward money was made public. But that was just the start. The floodgates on jailhouse snitches against both Joey and Mark was about to burst right open. Next time on Undisclosed.
And that wraps up episode 16 of the second season of Undisclosed. Hey, listeners, we got two events going down in Georgia where you'll have the opportunity to meet the folks of the Georgia Innocence Project and co-host of Undisclosed, Susan Simpson. Event number one goes down on Monday, November 14th in Atlanta, Georgia. GIP, Susan, and crew are going to be at the Marsha Wood Gallery in Midtown Atlanta, starting at 8 p.m. and going all the way to 10 p.m. The gallery's at 1037 Monroe Drive Northeast. Again, that's Monday, November 14th, starting at 8 p.m. in Atlanta. If you didn't get the chance to come out and see the team on Monday night, or you want to see them again, they'll be in Rome the very next day, Tuesday, November 15th, meeting with you at the Sarah Hightower Regional Library. Address on that is 205 Riverside Parkway Northeast. Again, that's in Rome, Georgia. And they'll be available to meet you on November 15th. Come on out. Meet the good folks at the Georgia Innocence Project and Susan Simpson. Ask them some questions. Talk about the show. It'll be a good time, I promise. And now on to the credits. The most special thanks, as always, goes to the good folks of the Georgia Innocence Project. You can check them out at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Hey, when you go to that website, look at the top right. You're going to see a word that says donate. You should do that. Because every little dollar that you give counts. Our wonderful sponsors for the week include ABC's legal drama, Conviction. New episodes of Conviction drop on Mondays. Longtime friend of the show, Stamps.com. Stamps, thank you for continuing to support us. And our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories, produces this show. She gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence podcast. Methil Telhan is the super producer behind the scenes who keeps this whole thing going. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez composed the theme music. Baluki did the logo. Christy Williams and Nina Mooser did our website. On that website, you'll find links to our social media accounts. You can get at us using the handle @UndisclosedPod on the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Instagrams. Keep the conversation going using #Undisclosed, #JusticeForJoey, or if you want to ask Mr. John Cryer at the Undisclosed Addendum a question, tweet at him using the #UDAddendum. Your executive producer for Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to seeing you for next week's episode. Until then.
Hi guys, I've got a special announcement for all of our Georgia listeners who plan on voting tomorrow, November 8th. One of the measures on the Georgia ballot this year is Amendment 3, which would amend the Georgia Constitution to eliminate the Judicial Qualifications Commission, or JQC, an independent state agency that oversees complaints of judicial misconduct. The Georgia legislature wants to replace this independent agency with one that they control. In the past 10 years, nearly 6 dozen judges in Georgia have been removed or have resigned from the bench following investigations by the JQC. In fact, one of those judges, Representative Johnny Caldwell Jr., is now in the Georgia Congress and is one of the sponsors of the amendment. Before voting tomorrow, I'd like to encourage you to read up on what Amendment 3 will do and why we at Undisclosed believe that the JQC has been a force of transparency and accountability for Georgia's judiciary. We'll post links on our website with more information, but Episode 599 of This American Life has a great summary of the issue that's absolutely worth listening to. And for those of you who do plan voting no on Amendment 3 tomorrow, make sure to tell your friends and family what this measure will do. The ballot is confusingly worded and suggests that a yes vote will, quote, allow the Judicial Qualifications Commission to be open to the public in some manner, suggesting that a yes vote on Amendment 3 is a vote for transparency, when in fact, the opposite is true.